We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Mike DeCourcy talking college hoops with Mully and Haw. The Sporting News, Big Ten Network. He's a Liverpool supporter, but we let him on the show anyway. Mike DeCourcy on 670 The Score.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. Liverpool dropping points recently, and of course, I don't know if you saw what City's doing, Mike, but it's kind of scary. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Morning, Mike.
I'm great, Mully. How are you? Hi, Dave.
All right, let's talk some college hoops. What did you make? First of all, do you like what they're doing in terms of copying maybe what's working in college football? The whole idea of putting out a poll and keeping everyone informed and making it something that you're supposed to look forward to. What's your take on it as theoretically the entire process?
I don't like it. I compare it to when you're at Christmas and you're a kid and your parents say, "Oh, by the way, this is what we're buying you for Christmas." So be real surprised when you open the presents on Christmas Day. I've always looked at Selection Sunday as sort of this wonderful event that everything is a surprise, and you may in your minds by then believe that this and this is going to happen. And usually it's not that terribly hard to figure out, like, if Duke continued to do what they're going to do, that we know that they're going to go to D.C. For the Sweet 16 and that sort of thing. And Gonzaga would most likely be in the West as either a one or a two. And we all know that kind of stuff. But the greater part of it is a surprise. And they steal the surprise away. And I don't think that it really serves any purpose at all.
I think it serves a purpose, Mike, only if you like the idea of a trial balloon. It feels like a trial balloon. Let's see what's out there. Let's see what the reaction is, and let's see how many people complain about Gonzaga, for instance, being a fourth seed and overall, and what they'll go back and reconvene and maybe look at things a different way. I don't know, but I tend to agree with you. I think it does maybe take away some of the suspense element from Selection Sunday. That said, when they did come out with the rankings on Saturday, what was your biggest surprise, and how would you interpret what we saw from 1 through 16?
I think it's a very minor surprise, but I was surprised that Michigan was their sixth team and Kentucky was their fifth. I don't know what they base that on. They had about the same number of big wins. They both have identical losses in terms of the number, but Kentucky's losses are to Alabama and to Seton Hall, one of which, or actually both of which, may not make the field. They both could, but they're not in. They're not squarely in. Whereas Michigan lost, for instance, to Wisconsin and to Purdue, both of which were on the board. They were in the top four seeds for one of the regions. So I don't understand that. Because it would dictate that, for instance, if Virginia were to fall off the line, would Kentucky be the next one to go up? I don't understand that at all. Plus, the reality is that the Big Ten has been the strongest league this year, and Michigan right now is in line, although it may not be by the end. But right now, it's in line to win the best league. So, I don't understand that at all, and that part really shocked me. When I looked at the first four teams, I thought they had them exactly right and in the exact right order. But really, to sort of sit on the Big Ten in that way was kind of a surprise.
They said that Villanova was maybe the 17th team, whatever, just outside the top 16. They play Marquette coming up. Do we look at that game as more significant than we would have because of these ratings?
Well, the first Marquette game on Saturday was a great game, and and the Golden Eagles were able to squeeze out a win. They had a nice lead and almost let it go, but they got a stop on the last possession and were able to win. And I think the rematch becomes really significant for a couple of reasons. One, Marquette is still in the picture to win the Big East championship and maybe climb on that seed board a little bit. And obviously, if Villanova's able to win that game when they rematch, I would think that at that point they would get on the board and Marquette might fall off it.
You know, Mike, when you look at the national perspective, because of your experience, I think you have, you know, you put this into some context, but everybody in Chicago is talking about Zion Williamson, and I don't think I saw a more athletic play in college basketball than that block the other night. But I think when you look at his body of work this season and the impact that he's made on the game, what do you compare it to? And we've heard a lot of lofty comparisons, and we've heard a lot of great things said about the young man, but in your mind, what is he comparable to?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Dave. I wrote an article about a month ago or so when I basically said, stop comparing him to people because you've never seen anything like this. Which isn't to say that I think he's the best player I've ever seen, but I've never seen anyone who does the things he does at the size he is. That block was ludicrous to be able to come from the lane in the time. I mean, he was in the lane, on almost on the opposite side of the lane when the shooter had the ball in his hands. I mean, he wasn't ready to shoot it, but he had it in his hands, and he came all that way and was able to block the shot, and he blocked it not at the guy's release, but after it had traveled a little bit. That's how high he was. He's 6'7", 285 pounds, and he's an A-plus run-jump athlete. There's never been anything like this. And I always tell this story when I first went to see him. I went to a tournament after having been to another in the summer before his senior year, and I show up, and they're out of rosters. And so they have no roster, but they have a schedule, and I know which team he's on. So it says, okay, Zion's playing in 5 minutes on court four or whatever. So I go over to court four, and I'm trying to figure out, okay, which one is he? Because I've seen him do the dunks and all that on YouTube. And so I get there, and I look out on the floor, and I see this guy. And I said, well, that can't be him. That must be some kid that's going to go play offensive tackle at Clemson next year, and he's just keeping in shape playing ball. And then he dunks one, and I'm like, oh, my God, that's him. It's the craziest thing we've ever seen in terms of the size and the dynamism. And you know, look, LeBron, I saw LeBron when he was a junior to be in high school. And I wrote that week that it was like seeing Magic Johnson's head on Michael Jordan's body. That was the body LeBron wore when he was a high school athlete or a young 17, 18-year-old. Zion's wearing the body of the Chicago Bears left tackle doing those things.
Can he be a bull then? That's all people want here.
Oh, well, you know, I think anybody that gets him is going to get a special player. I don't know that, you know, I don't know whether or not somebody who is that big is going to be able to hold. You know, he's not heavy. People look at him, and the people who play against him, the fans who play against him want to think he's fat or overweight or whatever. No, he's a block of granite. But, you know, does that hold up in 100 games? Again, we've never seen this before, so we don't know what it's going to be like. But he's going to be a very, very good pro. He's going to play in all-star games and all that. And if he proves as a three-point shooter and his body holds up, you know, he's going to be a superstar.
Tennessee is the second pick, I suppose, if the tournament starts today, right?
Yeah.
Now, they are the number one pick in the AP. They sit at number one. They haven't lost since... before Christmas, end of November or something? Crazy.
Yeah.
But they're not playing anyone, I guess, right? Now they play Kentucky. Now we'll find out more about them. But how you know, does the AP poll move Duke ahead of them because of the win over Virginia? Or do you say, well, they didn't do anything to go down in the poll. So how do you balance that, and how does the tournament selection committee balance something like that?
Well, I think that if, let's say, for instance, I mean, they have two games against Kentucky, one of them on the road, obviously, and then they have another against LSU. And if they were able to win all of those games, I mean, if they close without losing, or if you give each if you give them one loss and Duke another loss, because remember, Duke has to play Carolina twice, home and road. So, I mean, if they each got one loss, I mean, it's possible that Tennessee could move ahead even, because they would have beaten Kentucky and LSU, for instance. I think that, you know, the poll never really has mattered much to me, I know it hasn't mattered to the committee. They're going to do what they believe. But the key here is that each of them would be a one seed, and each of them would be granted the geographic preference regardless. Right. Duke will stay in the East and get a chance to go to D.C. Tennessee would go to Louisville, which is closer to them, I believe, geographically than D.C. would be. And so it's going to work out fine. But guys, the thing that I love about this Tennessee team, and I just was down there last week to watch them play, they don't have a single player. They are the number one team in the country. They do not have a single player in their rotation, top 9-10 guys, that were ranked inside the top 125 prospects in their class. And here they are at number one. It's the most remarkable thing that I can remember seeing in terms of development and scouting, to be able to be that good. Grant Williams, who's probably the second best player in college behind Zion, Grant was the 191st player in his class, and he's tearing up the SEC. It's an amazing story.
Mike, back to the Big Ten before we let you go. Here locally, Northwestern blew a lead last night against Iowa. That was a tough one to take. Illinois is coming off two pretty big victories, including one over Michigan State. How would you describe their respective seasons to date?
Well, I think that they're going in opposite directions at the moment. Northwestern is really struggling, and they're older. Well, for instance, last night toward the end of the game, I mean, we didn't see much of the younger players for Northwestern, and the veteran players allowed that lead to go and struggled with the pressure. Whereas Illinois is creating that kind of pressure for opponents. They've had a very challenging season early because their schedule was just ridiculously hard, and they weren't ready for it, but they're getting better. DeSumo is terrific, and Georgie Bashanishvili was just magnificent last week, had a record 35. He knocked my buddy Deion Thomas off the freshman scoring record.
Saw that.
With his 35 points. I felt so bad for Deion. I wanted to call him and say sorry. And of course, Deion's the best, one of the nicest men, and he was there to see it. And I know I saw a picture of him congratulating Georgie. As graceful a man as you could want to be, as you could want to meet. And so I bet that was pretty cool for Georgie to be able to see Deion after he did it and to get that sort of congratulations.
Great stuff, Mike, as always. Thank you, buddy.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, fellas.
That is Michael DeCourcy, sporting news columnist, Big Ten Network analyst.
Great perspective. Interesting things to say about Zion Williamson. Again, you keep on hearing the praise. And you know, Mike is not somebody who's prone to exaggeration.
No. I mean, it's the kid's unbelievable.
It is.
It's unbelievable. I mean, his size, and again, it's his girth, and it's his explosiveness.
It's all those things, and I'm not exaggerating incredible. About that block. Do yourself a favor.
Go
look it up online, YouTube
check it out,
and find it, and then pick
then
your
we'll
jaw up off the ground, because it's something else.
312-644-6767. We're going to switch gears a little bit. Let's talk some baseball. A couple of interesting things coming out about the Manny Machado sweepstakes, and of course, Yu Darvish.
Oh, yeah, your daily Yu Darvish update.
Yeah, always fun to hear from Yu Darvish, especially if he's going to do great things for Chicago and the Cubs. Mully and Haw on the score.
I couldn't do anything for last year for Cubs, you know. I really loved the fans and then this organization, but I couldn't do anything. So I really want to do something for the Chicago and then the Cubs.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670, the score. That is the voice of Yu Darvish. Yu Darvish is a pitcher for the Chicago Cubs.
And you know what's amusing about that? Is people probably heard that and like, who is that? Because you don't really know what he sounds like.
Speaks perfect English.
Well, he does.
He at least didn't do interviews in English. Now he's doing them exclusively
in English.
And that's
not that is not a judgment or an opinion about his voice or anything like that. It's that we heard so little from Yu Darvish his first season as a Cub that when he speaks now as openly as he has, it's like as he did at the Cub convention, like, boy, you know, that's what he sounds like. That's what
do you
that's who Hugh is.
Again, he said some things. I thought the most interesting thing he said is that the velocity out of the bullpen, last year at this time, it was like 88 miles an hour when he was working out. Now it's 92. So if his velocity is up 4 miles per hour, and then by the time he gets on the field and you add adrenaline and all that, you would think that he would be significantly faster than he was a year ago.
Well, so, I hope so, Mully.
So you're skeptical of everything he says, even if he says it in English.
I want to be fair here.
And by that, I just mean that he didn't talk. He didn't speak. We know that he can speak English, but he chose to use a translator a year ago, which made him even more kind of standoffish and mysterious, if you will.
It contributed, but my overarching point, though, is that we didn't hear from Yu Darvish because he had nothing to say, because he was nowhere to say it. He wasn't around. Yeah. He wasn't available. He wasn't on the mound. He wasn't in the clubhouse. He wasn't in a position to comment on anything except for an injury that lingered that we kept hearing he was going to be coming back from, and he didn't. Look, it's February 11th, and I want to be fair here, but we're hearing – I'm already reaching Darvish fatigue level because – I'm to the point where it's show me, don't tell me.
Yes.
And he is, it's easy to probably get 4 miles per hour on your fastball in sunny in 80 degree weather.
Well,
how are you going to be in May 10th at Wrigley Field when it's 48 degrees and blustery?
But in fairness to the guy, if he had an injury a year ago that was so significant that he lost 4 miles an hour off his pitches, then presumably, even if it is in sunny Arizona, if he's pitching that much faster now, then that would jump when you get into actual games.
Thank you. Okay, you're right. I am done with my sins. I'm back to being optimistic about Yu Darvish.
Do I seem overly optimistic about Yu Darvish?
You know what? This is good. It's cathartic. I have to watch myself from being too overly cynical when it comes to Darvish. And I think that Cubs fans probably do too. There was so much expected from him,
yes,
maybe unrealistically, last year. And I've caught myself in that club because the day that he was signed, I think maybe a year ago today or a year ago this weekend, I thought that it was the missing piece.
It was a year ago. I think it's a year ago today.
And I thought that it was like, okay, now this is a rotation. This is the team that's announcing it's going back to the World Series, all those things. And then when he consistently was unavailable and even more consistently mysterious about his availability, I think that I got like to the point where you count on nothing when it comes to Yu Darvish. I vowed to start over. I think I said that a couple weeks ago. Fresh start in the way that I'm viewing Yu Darvish. So I think that's probably the way to look at it.
But I also do believe that you're right when you say that you want to see it from him. Because hearing it, not that you heard any stuff from him before he became a Cub, but hearing it isn't doing it, and you want him to just do it. And it would be great if you didn't hear from him and you just saw him do it. But, and I get that. I really do. I understand that impulse. Having said that, he is a big essential part of this thing. He needs to be a lot better, not just than he was a year ago, but a lot better, period, end of story, if the Cubs are going to make a jump that we hope they do and that is not predicted of them by the fine folks at Baseball Prospectus, whose Pecota ratings had them finishing third in the division. If Darvish can be what they thought they were signing, you're going to be hard pressed to see them finish third in a division.
When you take a step back and you look at the Cubs roster and you evaluate the strengths of this team, I think any objective person would look at that and say the strength is a starting rotation if they stay healthy. That's a big if. Pecota's basing a lot of the projections on last year and about numbers and about things that really will lead you to believe how they got to the 82 victory prediction, which I think is way low.
You'd like to think that's the aberration last year, not the standard.
Yeah,
right?
Last year was maybe the exception to the rule.
They've been updated over the weekend. They're down to 81, by the way.
Are you serious?
Yes. They did?
Yeah.
What happened? How did they lose a game?
I don't know. The computer spins weird tales.
Framing.
Oh, my God. Oh, stop.
Yeah, Wilson Contreras just allowed another run to get in. Okay. The great Milwaukee Brewer.
It's all about framing.
So I think
so. There were so many complaints that they ran the numbers again and they took away a win.
81.
That's awesome.
That's a 500 team. I don't think this is a 500 team.
I don't either.
And I think most of the optimism that you build around the Cubs heading into spring training is, okay, yeah, they have a great core. Yeah, they have great hitters, and Javi's this and Rizzo was that. but it's because of the strength of the starting pitching rotation. Those five guys, if they can give the Cubs what is on the back of their baseball cards, it's going to be a good year at Wrigley Field. It's going to be positive if they can figure out some other questions with their bullpen, with the consistency with hitting, but the strength starts with the starting pitching.
As much as you tire of the Yu Darvish story, as much as it's show me and I don't want to hear it, how does that translate into off-season baseball signings? The fact that 60-plus star players or good players are still on the market and two superstars in particular are still there. Are you tiring of the Manny Machado to the White Sox or Manny Machado not to the White Sox? Manny Machado, the Yankees have jumped in with $220 million. Manny Machado, the Sox actually offered $75 million more than reported.
I kind of feel like if you – kind of the way that Rick Hahn must feel about it, and I'm not comparing, you know, our perspective and stake in it as much as the Sox general managers, but if you're in it, you stay in it till the end.
Yes.
And this is all part of that. The speculation is just tiresome, and yeah, you're sick of reading about whispers and reports, and maybe the Yankees are back in it, and maybe the Yankees will make this offer. Maybe the Sox will go – it's all noise. It's all noise, but just noise that you have to just put up with, cover your ears, brace, you know, strap it down, as Hawk would say.
Yep.
You're in it for till the end, because if you're the Sox, you don't make any sort of demands and artificial deadlines, and we need an answer by this. You need an answer by opening day, okay? You're in it as long as you need to be in it if you have an opportunity to sign a guy like Machado.
And presumably there is a plan B somewhere, but why would you start dipping into that yet? What I find interesting is that with Machado in particular, you've made an offer. It seems to be a reasonable offer, but it's not one that he wants. He wants a different offer, so he's still hunting for it. Why would you up your offer until you find out what the other offer is, if he gets another offer? You may end up with the best offer, for all we know. Now, the idea that you're allowing other teams to get back in and, oh, no, here come the Yankees – the fact is that you've made an offer. If he gets another offer, he can come back and just try to shop it to you. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe he really wants to go somewhere else. But I think if as long as you have the only offer or the best offer on the table, why would you mess with it?
Ever sold a house? Ever bought a car? I mean, these are things that, you know, the way that we can relate to this kind of idea, I guess. Because
it reminds me when I bought my boat. I don't own a boat. I've never bought a boat.
You don't seem like a boat guy.
No.
Reminds me when I bought my bike.
I don't have the money for a boat, nor do I have the time to boat.
I could see you with the captain's hat on, though.
I do have an outfit I like to wear.
The boating shoes, yeah.
Yeah, the outfit has nothing to do with owning a boat.
With a pipe?
Yeah, corncob pipe.
I like to dress as a pirate.
I was thinking more an eye
home,
patch.
But I don't see why. Exactly.
I don't see why that's
paired on your shoulder. Why is that anyone's business?
Molly Hawker. It's a Molly Hawker. Get back, matey. I'm Molly, matey.
All that came from Treasure Island, you know, the whole like R and all that pirate stuff came from the mind of a writer.
A sword clenched between his teeth.
I don't think they actually were doing that. And they weren't as like swashbuckly as you think. They were kind of vicious, bloodlusty more than swashbuckly.
I like that word, swashbuckly, as an adjective.
Thank you. I've been trying to use
I think you invented
words.
It, though.
No.
I don't think that's a word, actually.
Olebas is the word that you invented.
It's like, what?
So you only get this kind of material from two great writers hosting the morning show here.
Scoreboard update.
From this
Christosis nasty, Alathosis nasty.
Yeah, that too.
Securing a premium free agent at this time could conceivably accelerate that process, could give us a little more margin of error, let's say, on the talent that we've already brought in. But if we, for whatever reason, fall short at this juncture, one, it's not going to change what we've already put together and the very positive trajectory we're on. And two, it isn't going to be the last bite at the apple, so to speak. It's not going to be our last opportunity to add premium talent.
Mullet at Hall, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. We're delighted to welcome in James Fegan, writes White Sox for The Athletic. Good morning, James. How are you?
Good morning, James.
Good, and you?
Oh, you know, really looking forward to a baseball season and to really looking forward to a resolution with this friends and family plan and whether it works with Manny Machado. What are your thoughts on this? There's so many conflicting reports that keep coming out. The Sox have made an offer. We know that. We don't know the actual numbers. There have been, I think, 75 million different offers between those numbers, 175, 250. Don't know where it lands. But is this all? I mean, I know you write today about the waiting game, you know, the where you're at, the ghost of Manny, kind of the mirage in the desert. Is when do you make a decision on when does he get signed or not signed? And as time goes on, is it in the White Sox favor? Is it against him? And I guess ultimately, does it matter?
Does it matter to get Manny Machado?
Does it matter if they can't get him signed before camp or whatever? Can't get him to come in before training camp is over? I know Manny Machado would make a huge difference. I'm saying when we keep sitting here playing around with the numbers and all the rest of it, it's getting tiresome.
I would say if there's any team that it really doesn't matter when, it's probably the White Sox, since, you know, it's not like 2019 is probably the least important year of Manny Machado under contract for them, since it's basically – It's not a function of need right now or making the playoffs in 2019. You're trying to get him for the long term for hopefully, you know, 7 or 8 years competing for a long window. So if there's any team that would probably shrug off the idea of Manny Machado being rusty and missing spring training, it would probably be them. And they have all the reason in the world to just kind of be patient and not push the process, because there's not necessarily an urgency in that respect. And, you know, Rick Hahn has always comes off very agnostic about kind of the weird developments of recent in the market, because he says that the only thing he cares about is the White Sox getting the best result. He doesn't care about shifting. He doesn't care about rule changes. He just cares about the White Sox adapting to him. And in the same way, he doesn't care about, you know, the fact that this is dragging on to a way that tortures the fans all offseason, because if it still results in Manny Machado being on the team, you know, in 2020 and beyond, you know, that's all that really matters to them. So this process being agonizing and weird, and 2019 being this weird kind of nightmarish process of will he or won't he, it really doesn't matter to the White Sox end goal at the end of the day.
And I think, James, you're right. I think that depending on what Machado says, it'll determine how you feel about the White Sox's offseason overall. I believe it is truly a referendum on the Sox offseason. That said, up to this point, how would you evaluate the moves that they have made, and especially what their bullpen looks like after those moves?
There's no move that I really look at too hard and say, like, well, that's a mistake or that's misguided. It's a lot of just kind of small improvements. Most of the time, especially with Alonso and Colome and Herrera, they're kind of giving themselves a two-year window where the guy would overlap, not just be a 2019 upgrade for a team that's, you know, ostensibly a rebuilder, but has some potential to be on the first kind of good team that has a rotation, that has Michael Kopech and Dylan Cease on it, and thus kind of has the starting pitching to really do something potentially, but also may still be a year early, and also kind of has enough team control where they have a hot start. Maybe there's someone that can flip the deadline. So they're kind of putting their foot in two worlds with most of their major acquisitions, and most of their acquisitions, even if they're not stars, they're kind of clear improvements over you know, what they had past season, and kind of a better use of their time to give them plate appearances to either rebuild their value or kind of, you know, move towards what's going to be a decent contending team in 2020. So it's all kind of good stuff. None of it is really necessarily transformative. This is a long-term solution. This answers the question for this position for the, you know, contending window, which is kind of why it's a great offseason if they land a guy who does that, Manny Machado. And it's an offseason you might not really remember, you know, 2, 3, 4 years from now if they don't land Machado.
What's the future of their rotation? Do we know that yet? Carlos Rodon presumably will be healthy. I mean, it'd be nice. Where are you with Ronaldo Lopez, with Giolito? I mean, Kopech's injury really kind of stopped a lot of the buzz that this team was hoping to build a year ago, for sure. Where are you at with who's fits in and who doesn't fit in? Or do you even know where any of these guys – is Carson Fulmer still alive? Is he still going to be at camp? I mean, it just seems like that was 100 years ago.
I said at the time, and I haven't really found a reason to back off of it, that Kopech going down really kind of took away any like the most dreamy notion of them being a year early and competing this year. I really don't think the rotation is kind of a proving ground this year more than it's ready to really, you know, carry a team to any kind of playoff contention, even with the Cleveland Indians increasingly weak and vulnerable by the moment. I would say it's the weakest unit on the team right now and probably the reason they'll make the playoffs, but it's probably the most interesting as far as the long-term rebuild, because this season is going to be about figuring out, is Carlos Rodon a top rotation guy in that going forward, or is he kind of a mid-rotation guy? Is Ronaldo Lopez, I think he pitched as well as anybody on the staff the last 2 months. Is that real? Is that going to make him a number three, long-term, or is he going to fall back towards something else, or maybe even be, you know, kind of the hard-throwing super reliever when this team is really all good and everything coming? I hesitate from saying it's a true make-or-break year from Lucas Giolito, but definitely if he has a year like last year, you're probably, looking for ways to kind of push him out of the rotation, whereas, you know, he could also stay claim to a spot if, you know, all the changes that he says he's put in place kind of show out. You mentioned Fulmer. I know he went to a drive line, which has turned around a lot of careers over the offseason, but at this point, I don't think the White Sox are, you know, pushing all their chips in on that. They're kind of going to keep him in the bullpen. He's probably going to start the season AAA, and if he shows that he's a new guy, he'll probably be given opportunities to rise, but I think it's going to come pretty slowly. You know, I think it's probably been 5 or 6 years since anybody was really familiar with Manny Benuelos as a top prospect with the Yankees. But the White Sox are touting that they basically think he's a nice little reclamation project find. And it seems like he's going to get the fifth starter slot at this point.
You know, James, when you look at the realities of this offseason, all the focus on Machado has prevented people from obsessing on the development of Yoan Moncada and what's next for him and maybe what he didn't live up to last season. When you look ahead, what is at stake for him this season? Where is he? And what do you think his best position is moving forward?
You know, I think if he was ready for it and, you know, approached it and dedicated himself to it, just the physical tools he has, having just such a cannon of a throwing arm, third base is probably the best fit for his skill set. And just as, you know, the fact that on balance, you know, Nick Madrigal, probably his throwing arm is maybe the weakest part of his skill set, I think the ideal role for the two of them, if they were together, would be Madrigal second and Moncada third. But at the same time, I don't think there's any kind of immediate pressure for Moncada to, you know, kind of show it or lose his spot anytime soon. He's still kind of in a relaxed spot, and I don't think infield depth is not really the strength of the White Sox prospect base at this point. It's a lot of guys who are still in the low minors who would ever challenge him. And, you know, we probably forget a little bit too much that Moncada is not that removed from being a number one overall prospect, and there's still kind of incredible offensive physical tools that could be, you know, if he untaps them or figures anything out, could probably show themselves, could probably emerge pretty quickly. But at the same time, it's probably for the best that, you know, we have kind of removed ourselves from thinking that he's going to be this MVP type guy or middle of the order, you know, elite run producer, and probably be more satisfied if he's just kind of a guy who gets on base and is solidly above average and is just a good second baseman long-term rather than the face of the franchise.
All right. So, you know, we always talk about the young players, and Aloy is, you know, this year will be his year, just not probably the beginning of the year. What about Dylan Cease, and who else is on the come that could make an impact this year? Or is there, are you still a year or two away with some of this stuff?
I've been a little surprised how open they've been about, if Dylan Cease is a normal year, he's going to be in the majors by the end of the season. It seems like they're a bit more, you know, I wouldn't say deceptive, but not kind of like, you know, conservative as far as like putting that expectation on Michael Kopech last year. But Dylan Cease are pretty open. If he has a normal Dylan Cease season, he'll be in the rotation probably by the end of August. And, you know, that kind of, with that spells, at the end of August, whoever's not performing well in this current rotation will probably have had a decision made about him and be replaced by Dylan Cease. Dane Dunning is probably way too polished for AA if he's healthy, and will probably be, you know, pushing on the door or, you know, making a good case for a late September call-up if they want to hand it to him. I know with pitchers, they're a bit more aggressive as far as giving them that late season promotion because, you know, there's you don't necessarily want to hold that guy down forever. Dunning's a college guy who's going to be, you know, 25 by the end of the year. You don't want to wait around forever with that. Jimmy Lambert and Bernardo Flores aren't quite on the same level of him as far as, you know, prospect pedigree, but they're just as mature. So if they have strong years, they'll theoretically be, you know, the most qualified starting pitching prospects in Charlotte by the end of the season. So it's possible to see them as well.
So, James, you went on a trip to the Dominican, correct? And your story about Ronaldo Lopez was fascinating, and I also enjoyed you writing about Dylan Cease and the way that he's incorporated yoga. And I think you've spent a lot of time around these guys. Those are two guys in particular the White Sox fans hope that they get very familiar with. What kind of insight can you lend in terms of what you expect out of both those guys and just those two experiences?
You talk to Dylan Cease, and he's probably pretty reserved and very doesn't really expand upon the idea that he's just focused on his pitches and execute. He'll say the term executing pitches about, you know, 10 times for interview, and you wonder how much is there. But if you kind of talk to him and get him going, he's really pretty in-depth guy. He's put a lot into trying to relax himself and control himself on the mound. You know, I knew some of the stories that I encountered with Ronaldo about, you know, the circumstances he grew up in, and that his family had to sell the family cow to get him his first sports equipment. But just going to his place and seeing the neighborhood he grew up in, and just kind of how little he had in terms of like resources, and you know, his grandmother talking a lot about just feeling like she couldn't believe that he was ever going to be a prospect because she didn't feel like she had the resources to give him the nutrition to grow up to be as strong as he is. You know, you kind of appreciate what he's been through. I mean, we kind of think of him as a guy who hasn't even, you know, began to untap his potential yet because he's 99, but, you know, kind of so much went into that process to kind of build out on the very thin frame that he had and the maturity that he's found in his arsenal based on basically still being a catcher / third baseman at 16 when most Dominican prospects are already, you know, working with a team facility and have been, you know, in the eyes of scouts for years. You know, Ronaldo's kind of gone through so much development over the past five seasons that you kind of astounded where how far he's gotten. The fact that he still has, you know, maybe another level to get to if, yeah, you know, he finds consistency with that curveball and he's as comfortable with that changeup as he was the last 2 months of last season. It's kind of astounding, you know, how far you get just to be a young and inexperienced pitcher in the majors. You know, it's been an incredible journey for him.
Zach Collins, a guy that you're still waiting on. Can he be a catcher? Is he not a catcher? What about Zavala as a receiver, Sebi Zavala? I mean, I don't know that they have a guy that you project immediately as a catcher, but those are two guys. I mean, has Zavala passed Zach Collins or not?
I would say he's passed him in terms of maturity, or, you know, he's a year or two older than Collins. I would say he's passed him in terms of major league readiness. As far as a receiver, he's just kind of a bit more polished in that end. I wouldn't say he's necessarily passed him on like the organizational standings of who they expect to be their primary catcher of the future. I think they've never really wavered on Zach Collins since they drafted him. I mean, the day they drafted him, they had plenty of scouts and evaluators telling him this guy is not a catcher. So they didn't respond to that, and they've kind of continued to develop him as such, and they've never really gotten up the idea that, you know, this isn't, you know, moving as fast as we need it to, so we're going to move him to first base. I would expect, you know, all things being equal, Zach Collins is probably going to have a first baseman in Chicago at some point.
Right.
If for no other reason than he's going to be in a timeshare with Sebi Zavala, you know, down the road. And, you know, if Zach Collins becomes the bat you want him to be, you're not going to have him catching 140 games per season, because that doesn't really happen in major leagues anymore. And you're going to want to keep him off his feet. At the same time, you know, there's been defensive progress, but I don't think it's at the level yet, you know, talking to any evaluators outside the organization where he's proved all the doubters wrong. There's still a lot to go. He's starting in Charlotte, so theoretically he'd get the September call-up this year. But there's still the defensive development needs to happen before he's a guy you're necessarily starting behind the plate in playoff games. At the same time, you know, if you have the third overall pick this year and Adley Rutschman from Oregon State's on the board, I don't think Sebi Zavala or Zach Collins is such a iron grip on the catcher of the future that you don't still make that pick and add a guy who has the potential to be, you know, just a superstar catcher in your organization.
All righty, James. Thank you, buddy. Appreciate
good stuff.
It.
Thanks, James.
All right, thanks for having me.
James Fagan, I, you know, part of the problem is all the injuries that happened with the younger players, with the guys that are developing and all the different guys that you looked at and you thought, wow, this is going to be, he's going to be here. They, obviously, Kopech is the first name to come to mind, but there's a lot of them. There's a lot of guys that have run afoul of injuries. And
Berger.
And it's that's another guy, Jake Berger and, you know, Zach Birdie. I mean, you
last year was a very odd year and unfortunate one in terms of injuries for the White Sox and the prospects.
Yeah, it was a bit depressing, frankly. Yeah. But hopefully that's not the case. And yeah, do they need Manny? I'd say he'd make a pretty big
do you think they need Manny?
Yeah. I just mean it's not going to determine their results this coming year.
Yeah.
Mullion Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 6-7 to the score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.